Like, that's the only reason he
like right now it's
Hi, welcome everyone. Today is Monday, May 27th, 2015. Welcome to the House Committee on Human Services and Housing. And we have an informational hearing on Alzheimer's with a number of different people. Mm-hmm. Do you have an order?
I think that Larissa is going to come up first.
Larissa Kaufman?
Okay. Yeah. Larissa will come up first.
However you would like to organize it. Great. Thank you.
Chairwoman Kenny Geyer and members of the House Human Services and Housing Committee. For the record, my name is Jason Hess, and I'm the CEO of Elite Care. I wanted to thank you for your support of the state plan and your commitment to addressing Alzheimer's disease in Oregon. I had the privilege to serve as the co-chair of the task force that created the state plan for Alzheimer's disease in Oregon, which we refer to as SPADO. The process to create the state plan was very collaborative. My co-chair was Jennifer Mead from DHS and APD, and the task force included long-term care providers, staff of the state and county agencies, nonprofits including the Alzheimer's Association, AARP Oregon, researchers, educators from Portland Community College, and OHSU doctors, nurses, and social workers, elder law experts, and people who have had experience and impacted Alzheimer's in their own family and have been caregivers for loved ones. We are very thankful for the involvement of Senator Mona Sanderson and Representative Dembro on the task force. These stakeholders came together over nearly 3 years ago to create this plan, SPADO. The first meeting of the task force was held in November of 2010. It formed five groups to focus on specific areas. The specific areas were public education and awareness, legal and financial, the continuum of care, medical research, and public safety. In addition to the expertise of the group, the task force held six town hall meetings around Oregon and a telephone town hall meeting last year to get input on what should be in the state plan. Hundreds of Oregonians from Brookings to Pendleton and from Portland to Bend took part in these events and provided much useful information. Furthermore, we developed an online survey that hundreds of people filled out that gave us some further insight on the needs of people impacted by dementia and Alzheimer's in Oregon. Once the task force had heard all the public input, recommendations were written and then vetted through dozens of stakeholders in Oregon to get their feedback of the plan. The state of Oregon, in the culmination of this work, came together and created five goals and 10 recommendations, and Larissa will peel the onion and be a little more specific on some of those. And that represented actions that could be taken right away by state government, nonprofit, and the private sector working together to help with this disease. And I think, you know, if I look at it from the private and public sector working together, that was a real unique, collaborative way. And I think it was a sacred cow, really, in the way the state of Oregon has approached seniors and specifically Alzheimer's and dementia. While this may not address every need of every person impacted by Alzheimer's, the plan represents a starting point from which we can move forward from to ensure that services are provided in an effective and efficient manner and move us towards a world without Alzheimer's. These stakeholders continue to work together to make sure the plan is implemented and does not sit on the shelf gathering dust. Alzheimer's can't wait, so we will see this through.
Thanks. Good afternoon, Chair Kenny Geyer and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Larissa Kaufman, and I'm the Public Policy Director for the Alzheimer's Association Oregon Chapter. First, I'm going to start with some statistics on Alzheimer's and dementia in Oregon. There are approximately 60,000 people over the age of 65 who have Alzheimer's in Oregon, and that's about 10% of the senior population here. One in eight Oregonians older than 45 has reported experiencing causing confusion or memory loss. Of those, over 68% of them have not talked to a healthcare professional about it. Last year in Oregon, about 175,000 unpaid Alzheimer's and dementia caregivers provided nearly 200 million hours of unpaid care, valued at more than $2.4 billion. Since the state plan was released in 2012, there have been several significant accomplishments. Today, my testimony will focus on the state plan efforts in public education and awareness. In 2013, Oregon received a three-year federal grant from the Administration for Community Living, ACL, for nearly $750,000. The state contributed matching funds in the amount of $300,000. Thanks to the ACL funding, we accomplished one of the two public awareness goal recommendations in the state plan. In May 2014, as a subsection of the revamped Aging and Disability Resource Connection, ADRC, website, we launched a website that focused primarily on Alzheimer's and dementia resources. From January 2015 to March 2015, there were over 1,300 page visits directly to that page. Additionally, due to the ACL grant, dementia-specific training was provided to the ADRC staff to help increase expertise and understanding. By the end of the three-year grant, which is going to be in the fall of 2016, nearly 100% of the ADRC staff is going to be trained on Alzheimer's and dementia and resources out in Oregon that are provided. In addition to the ACL grant funding, in 2013 and 2014, because of the change in the senior medical deduction, legislators allocated $3.3 million in funding for caregiver and first responder training throughout the state. To date, nearly 4,000 classes have been completed through the Oregon Care Partners. We ask for your continued investment of the $3.3 million in funding for training, and we also ask for your continued support in funding for senior services and people with disabilities, because that helps move the state plan forward. Thank you so much for your time.
Good afternoon, Chair Kenny Geyer and members of the committee. My name is Maria Kane. As an educator with 37 years of experience in the field, I provide training to paid and unpaid caregivers as well as to first responders. I'd like to share a real-life situation with you where law enforcement training in Alzheimer's helped significantly. Several evenings a week, around 4 p.m., a man who had Alzheimer's disease aggressively kicked his wife out of their home. She would argue with him, explaining over and over again that she was his wife, tearfully pleading with him to please remember. The man was not aware that his guns had been snuck out of the house, and he would frequently threaten his wife and the officers who came to help that he would indeed shoot. By proceeding calmly and respectfully, the officers were able to calm the situation and worked effectively with the family and myself to come up with solutions. The man had confided to the officers that this lady thinks that she's my wife, but when my wife gets home, she's going to be very angry to have this old lady sitting in her chair. In the short term, we trained the wife to step out when he asked her to leave and come back in again saying, "Honey, I'm home," and that helped him reframe the situation. In the long term, we were able to secure a safer living environment for him where he could then enjoy safe visits with his wife. Officers credit the approaching Alzheimer's class, along with crisis intervention training, for helping them enhance their skills that they need in responding to difficult situations with persons with compromised ability to do reasoning and judgment, reasoning and decision making. The whole subject of Alzheimer's disease, though, changed dramatically a couple years ago, 2012, a few years ago. When my dad, Bill Whitney, was diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease. For several years prior to his diagnosis, he had been experiencing increased confusion and memory loss. In 2006, his doctor had noted MCI question mark, which means mild cognitive impairment, in his chart, but she hadn't voiced his concerns to us or to him. In the fall of 2011, we began seeking a diagnosis and guidance after he caught his kitchen on fire and drove his car through their double-story garage. In the beginning of 2012, my dad reluctantly engaged with the programs available through the Alzheimer's Association, and he quickly discovered that the emphasis was not on who he was as an Alzheimer's patient, but on who he was as an artist and a human being. His life opened up again to joy, creating, and relating. My dad, Bill Whitney, spoke at the press conference unveiling Spado and here at the Capitol, both in 2012. He felt very grateful for all the services he and my mom had received and wanted everyone in Oregon who has dementia and their family members to have access to the services that they need. He stated, "Instead of living in fear, I live with hope. My desire is for all Oregonians living with dementia to have the same hope." Bill Whitney passed away. Sorry. Gosh. Right. On March 2nd of 2014, about a year ago, my desire is to carry on his legacy of hope. I deeply appreciate the opportunity to speak with you today. And we all appreciate your ongoing support of the state plan for Alzheimer's disease.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions?
I have yes. One, if I may. So I just need a little education here. I represent Gresham, and we tragically had someone with Alzheimer's walk away, unable to locate in a certain period of time. And passed away. Mm-hmm. So I did a little research on a bill that had been passed a couple of years ago that put in sort of like the Amber Alert for... Mm-hmm. For the older generation, mm-hmm. So how does that work? Is it the same as the Amber Alert that we see for children, or how is that all? And is that up and running in our state throughout our state?
Yeah, I can speak
to
that. Yes. So the bill was passed in the state, and as of January 1st, 2015, every law enforcement agency in Oregon should have in place policies and procedures if a vulnerable adult goes missing. The discretion in terms of how to craft those is up to each individual law enforcement entity. So it varies. They were provided with model policies that they could put in place, and I actually worked a little bit with Washington County, the sheriff's office there, when they were working that out. As a sort of complement to that, although it's not required, the training that we provide is targeted to law enforcement and first responders to provide them with the education and the pieces. And we've had many law enforcement officers actually take that training. And we provide the training live, and we also provide it online.
Follow up. Yep. Counted every agency? Do we know that every agency has done that? And I'm not saying that's your responsibility. I'm just curious. Do we know?
You actually read my mind. Recently, I was thinking about it and plan to do some outreach to the different agencies to find out how that's going for them. I think it's really important to do that follow-up because that implementation is so critical. I'm happy to talk to you more about that.
Love that.
Yeah.
Thanks. I appreciate it.
Can I add something to your question?
You bet.
I'm one of the trainers that gets to go out and do the Oregon Care Partners class that the Alzheimer's Association developed called Approaching Alzheimer's. And just my experience actually getting to work with law enforcement and train those trainings, they report to me that they feel more empowered to deal with some of these situations, like looking for people. In fact, we had a gentleman leave his foster home where he lived, and it was reported back to me that when he got back, and it's in your printed materials, but when he got back, they did find him and got him safely returned to his foster home, and they were able to actually work with the people that owned the foster home to help devise a plan, and they felt empowered to do so because of the training.
And I really appreciate that, because I can tell you there's nobody finer than a police officer. Mm-hmm. So that's all there is to it. So that's my background, and that was my career.
Okay.
I appreciate that. And I do think law enforcement, and I think everybody, wants to have the tools and the opportunities to help in a wide variety of ways. So, but I would like to chit-chat later.
Okay.
Thank you. I'll follow up with you. Thank you.
Representative Stark.
Hey, thank you. You mentioned you had a whole list of statistics there at the beginning, and did you say that a certain percentage, I didn't catch all of them, did you say only a certain percentage actually seek medical care? And what was that percentage?
Yes. And so the percentage was about 68%, so close to 70%. And just to be completely clear, that's not actually the number of Oregonians who have been diagnosed with Alzheimer's or dementia. It is out of the number of Oregonians, which is 1 in 8, who have described or reported some cognitive decline. But what I will say is the national number in terms of actually diagnosing and being told of the diagnosis of Alzheimer's is less than 50% in this country. And as part of the state plan and one of our goal areas, we are actually working to, we're about to pilot with, we're recruiting physicians from around the state who we've developed two algorithms. One is for caregivers and one is for medical professionals to use to help with the diagnosis. And so we're piloting it. We're looking for about 50 primary care doctors to use the algorithm in their practice to help increase this. And I just also want to add that nationally, on the national level, there's been a bill that's been introduced. It's called the HOPE Act, that is focused specifically on the ability for doctors to be able to code in their medical records and also provide care planning. So it would be essentially something that's required of every single state. It's unfortunate, I just want to throw this in, I think we all feel this way, that this is something that we actually have to require by statute, but it is one of the biggest issues. My understanding is that, and this is before my time with the association, that this was one of the main issues, this sort of lack of support, this challenge in terms of understanding and getting a diagnosis here in Oregon.
And
everywhere.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. There's a dearth of talent, unfortunately. And realistically, with reimbursement rates and where things are going, there's not a lot of incentive for docs to focus in geriatric medicine, but if you look at the population, it's a monster market, and that's where it's heading. And so, you know, working with the med schools and figuring out ways to incentivize younger docs to start to focus in geriatric medicine, that's a critical success factor. And one thing I'll add really quick is, you know, when you're dealing with elopements, keep an open mind, because I think there's a tendency within humans to misdefine what safety means, and locking people up is not a quality of life. While they may not elope, there's not a quality of life thing. Mm-hmm. And realistically, if we're doing it right, we're, you know, compressing morbidity, where you're living well to the end of life. And so we got to figure out how to, training is like the biggest thing that we're working on in the public awareness. So.
Can we follow up?
Thank you, Chair. So your statistics left me more confused.
Okay.
So if you'll explain, because if Oregon has 68% seeking, that we have identified as symptoms for Alzheimer's, seeking some sort of medical assistance, mm-hmm. and nationwide 50% are seeking assistance, is that we're really good at identifying and getting them help, or is it that the rest of the nation is finding other ways of actually helping?
Chair Kenning-Geyer and Representative Stark. So just to clarify, it's actually 68% who do not seek assistance or do not relay that they're having cognitive decline issues to a medical provider. So, which actually falls in line with every other state. That's pretty much where we are around the country.
Can I ask you, 68% of those who you think actually have Alzheimer's?
No. 68% of people who have identified having some form of cognitive impairment issues.
Do not seek a formal diagnosis or do not seek help?
Yes.
And that's in line nationally?
Yes.
Okay. But nationwide, it's more like 50%.
What was 50%?
So the 50% is actually for individuals who do have Alzheimer's, that less than 50% are actually made aware of their diagnosis.
Okay.
So the summary is we have a long way to go in terms of raising awareness. Yeah, I got
that. Yes.
So I have a couple of questions, too. Oh, where you start?
Well, I just had a question about medication and longevity. I mean, I think with medication, we're keeping people alive longer, and even Alzheimer's patients. So is that really impacting, then, our service needs as well? I would imagine it does.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you look at modern medicine, it's not compressing morbidity, right? You're living longer. Yeah. You may not be at the highest quality of life. So that's, you know, it's one of those tipping points that you have to take into consideration when you medicate. And that's like a family philosophical discussion that, I don't have any statistics on it. But I think if you... From Elite Care's perspective, you know, we have a couple of silos that we look at, and really we focus, and I think a lot of the stakeholders that develop the state plan, we're focusing more in the social aspect and less on the clinical aspect. The clinical stuff we left to the experts to figure out, and I think they're making strides in that. But it definitely wasn't our focus, although we did have folks from OHSU participate. But I think at the end of the day, it was the awareness and the education, because there's so many folks that are giving care to people that have Alzheimer's and dementia and don't really know some of the simple social things that they can do to really impact somebody's life, like step out of the house and come back in and announce that, honey, I'm home. You know, I mean, that's a social win, not a clinical win.
And I just want to add that for Alzheimer's, there's no real treatment, there's no prevention, and there's no cure. And so in terms of the advocacy arena, we really are focusing on increasing research funding because we're very hopeful. And actually, we have someone on the second panel from OHSU who might be able to speak to the specific question a little bit more.
Good. That was going to be one of my questions, so I'll hold off on that. But just in terms of the task force, you mentioned Representative Denbrough, who's now a senator. We like to have a senator and a representative on task forces. So I'm curious if the task force is going to be continuing, and what are the big issues that, if so, you're going to be tackling? You're looking at policy areas. I see John Bartholomew from AARP. I'm assuming that maybe you were involved in the CARE Act, which is coming forward, which I think would be very helpful for your patients. But what are some of the policy things that you're looking at, and what going forward, what are you, how is it, going to continue operating?
Yeah, so I think at this stage we've transitioned from SPADO to SPADOIT, which is the SPADO implementation team, right? And so now it's figuring out within the stakeholders that created the goals and the recommendations, are those the right folks that are going to get us to implement it? And then within implementing it, you know, what are the key metrics that we know that are working and, you know, helping us achieve our goals. So that's kind of where we're at. I know that the Alzheimer's Association, ALRSA in particular, are, you know, tasked with helping bring those folks together and figuring out, you know, specifically how to get this implemented so that we reach these goals and it doesn't collect dust. In terms of the policy, I don't know if I can specifically talk on, you know, here's what we're going to be pushing.
Okay.
But I think it's pretty broad in terms of the group that will be on the team, and it will go across private and public.
Good. We'll be looking forward to the follow-up. Then,
yeah,
to
absolutely.
The SPADOIT.
SPADOIT.
Thank you so much.
Okay. Thank you.
Sorry on the loss of your father. Thank you for sharing the stories. Okay. So next up. Ashley Carson Cottingham, Fred Steele, and Allison Lindauer.
Good afternoon, Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee. My name is Ashley Carson Cottingham, and I'm the Deputy Director for Aging and Disabilities at the Department of Human Services. I'm here today to talk a little bit about Goal 4 of the state plan, and Goal 4 is improving access to quality care. And I'm going to focus in on 4A specifically. And so that goal was to develop appropriate care settings and services for persons with dementia who require a higher level of expertise and staff in helping manage their significant behavioral needs. So we have three achievements in this arena. DHS APD has been very active in developing settings and services for people with dementia who exhibit these significant behaviors. And so this work really helps us to prevent move-outs that are related to the behaviors. And we need to work on developing further settings that can appropriately support this population. So I wanted to give you a couple of examples of places that have been developed as a result of this goal. So in Bandon, we have a residential care facility that expanded their services to provide complex behavioral supports. So at that facility, we have 10 beds that are dedicated to supporting the population. All the beds are full, and all of the residents were able to come out of nursing facilities and into this setting type where there's additional staff to meet their needs. And the second example I'd like to share is around McKinsey Living Residential Care Facility in Lane County. And this facility supports people with dementia who also have additional mental health needs. And some of the features of this type of setting include the fact that each resident has their own room. There's a psychiatrist that is on site at the facility for 20 hours a month. There are six staff on duty in the day and into the evening, and then two at night. So it's a nice ratio of staff to residents. And all of the staff there have significant and relevant experience in a memory care type of setting before they come to work in this specialized setting. There's also 1.5 full-time equivalent employees on duty for activities for this particular population. And then they also have cameras and sensors on doors. So the second achievement in this arena is that we've been able to develop special needs contracts with APD Medicaid providers in residential care facilities. So some of the facilities that have been developed to serve this population, then also we do a special needs contract with that setting type to serve the Medicaid population. And so they ensure that there's a certain number of beds and person-centered support services for the population with significant behavioral needs. And then in addition to all that, the third achievement is that we provide behavior support services as part of the, our Medicaid Community First Choice or K state plan option. And this work is work with the providers in the consumer's environment to explore potential triggers and then develop an approach to improve quality of life and interactions between the consumer and their provider or caregiver. So it can be this behavioral support service can be provided in the person's home or in one of these specialized settings or other settings. And the way that it gets set up is through referral to the person's case manager, their Medicaid long-term services and supports case manager. And then it's also a required service in some of the settings that we've established the special needs contracts with. When the program was developed for behavioral support services, we developed a survey that the behavioral support specialist would leave with the provider after they've worked with the provider one-on-one so that we could have some way of knowing whether the services are working after the fact. And so just a couple of quick statistics of the surveys that we've received back. 65% of consumers were able to maintain the placement that they were in due to the services. 89% of the survey respondents, usually a community-based care provider is the person responding, said they responded in the affirmative that they would use the services again. And 57% of the consumers' behaviors decrease due to the behavioral support services.
Negative behaviors.
Pardon me?
Negative behaviors, I'm assuming.
Yes. So our next steps is are around ongoing evaluation of the effectiveness of these three achievement areas. And also the group that had been meeting as a result of the SPADO plan, they will be meeting again later in June. And they'll continue to look at the progress around these three priority areas. And then the department will continue to do ongoing reviews and work to develop further setting types. And this happens especially when the reviews come about often when a move out is occurring, and we're alerted that a move out is going to occur, and we're able to go in and really try to work with the facility to prevent the move out from occurring and allowing the consumer to stay in that particular setting type. And then we do ongoing monitoring on the special needs contracts. So we want to make sure that there's all the appropriate staffing in place according to the contract. The care planning is enhanced care planning. It's very person-centered. So we want to make sure that's always happening, and that the one key part of those contracts also is enhanced activities for persons with dementia. And so we work closely with the facilities to ensure that there's ongoing success for both the providers and the consumers living there. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. So, Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee, my name is Fred Steele. I'm not, am I on?
You're on.
I am. Thank you. I am what's referred to as the state legal services developer. It's a position created in the Older Americans Act, the much lesser known counterpart to the state long-term care ombudsman. And my role and the emphasis of my role is to work towards ensuring, at least as defined in the Older Americans Act, towards the rights of seniors in Oregon, older Oregonians, to ensure that their rights are protected or enhanced, and in particular, how they are protected and enhanced in the way that they engage in our long-term care, long-term services and supports infrastructure. The way it functions in Oregon, because of our approach at the Department of Human Services, I really look at or attempt to take my approach and work towards all vulnerable adults or potentially vulnerable adults and ensure proper infrastructures for those rights. So as that relates to the SPADO plan, I've been very fortunate, and I was very fortunate to be on a work group with the SPADO, the development of the SPADO plan, the legal work group led by an attorney in Portland, Tim Ney, and developing recommendations. And the one that I want to give an update on, and there's two components of what I want to talk to you about today, is one, an update on what is recommendation 3A, and then kind of that broader relationship of guardianship, conservatorship, and these fiduciary infrastructures in Oregon, and the need for continued improvement. So the work group developed a recommendation 3A. It was very specific to the need for guardian training. So you have somebody that's appointed, particularly family members, often, which often occurs with individuals and their family members, an individual with dementia, that they have a family member that can be appointed as a guardian or conservator to make decisions for them, either social or health decisions under guardianship or financial decisions under conservatorship. They go to court, go through the process, $5,000 to $7,000 later, they're patted on the back and told, good luck, make decisions. No real training available to them. Definitely recognized with the work group, again led by Tim Ney, and that made its way into the recommendation, a need not only for training, but specifically because of that large number of individuals with dementia that interact with our guardianship conservatorship system, that there needs to be some specific dementia training as a part of that guardianship training. So the status update on that starts with, so the report, the SPADO recommendations came out in 2012. By 2013, this wonderful body passed House Bill 3129 in 2013 to require certification of professional guardians and conservators. So starting in January 2014, that requirement, it's essentially enforced by the judges when they appoint professional guardians and conservators to make sure that they are certified. Obviously, a part of that certification is training, and at the national entity that does that training. Dementia is a component of their training. Onto the larger concern, the larger population of lay guardians or family guardians and conservators, there's been some work. There was some work initially out of the SPADO work, the SPADO recommendation to work on a manual with hopes of developing a training. Fortunately, some of the individuals that were involved in the work group for SPADO and this recommendation also became involved in a nonprofit in Oregon or in Multnomah County, at least where they're starting, Special Advocates for Vulnerable Oregonians. If you've been in touch with them or become familiar with them, they have two missions, one of which is to develop a training, and they've developed this training for lay guardians. In Multnomah County, as of August last year, all guardians appointed by the probate courts are required to take that training within 60 or 90 days. Just in the last couple of months, that's been expanded to Clackamas and Clackamas County courts. When they appoint guardians, conservators, they're required to take that training. The hope and ideal is to expand that requirement to all 36 counties in Oregon to take this highly and well-developed training by the, they kind of go by SAVO, but Special Advocates for Vulnerable Oregonians. So those are really the two components for the update on the recommendation. A wonderful progress, and I feel very fortunate to be connected to those individuals. From my role in the eye-opener that the SPADO plan was and the fiduciary relationships and the value and importance to vulnerable adults, and particularly in this context, those with dementia and the need for better supports, I was led down a path to convene a work group, I'd say, convene a group of stakeholders in Oregon. We refer to it as WINGS, which stands for Working Interdisciplinary Network of Guardianship Stakeholders. And I've had an opportunity to talk to a few different legislative bodies here in the last couple of years of the work that we're doing there. But we have approximately 35 stakeholders that have come together in Oregon. It's multidisciplinary, that interdisciplinary focus, to work on much of the guardianship conservatorship and fiduciary relationships, so powers of attorney, maybe advanced directives. I know there's a work group that's just convened under the guidance of Senate Judiciary to work on advanced directives and healthcare representatives and appointees there. That we want to approach these in a cohesive manner in Oregon so that we have healthier fiduciary infrastructure. The importance of that, and particularly how it relates to our populations with dementia, is that the more we push towards, in Oregon, but it's occurring nationally, the more we push towards a home and community-based services, that we have more home-based long-term care, long-term service supports in-home settings. These supports that are needed for decision-making, that an individual that needs somebody to help them with decision-making, whether it's social decision-making, financial decision-making, healthcare decision-making, the infrastructures need to be improved so that people aren't being abused, or at a more foundational level, that their independence is enhanced by decisions being made in the same way that they would make those decisions. And so the work that we've been doing with WINGS is working to coordinate some of those efforts around training, educational materials. In my written testimony, I have a link to some written materials and tools and guides that we've developed in our WINGS group, but also working to support efforts such as Representative Gallegos just last year with House Bill 4114 passing legislation to give clear authority to judges and probate judges in particular to appoint individuals to monitor guardianships and conservatorships that they have concerns over. There's the creation of the statewide public guardian office as passed by this body and championed by Senator Dembro and Representative Doherty and got that through last year. There's some legislation that Senator Dembro has this year looking at the rights of right to counsel for these proposed protected persons that are otherwise having their civil rights taken away without legal representation in courts. So I could go on and on. There's a number of efforts that we are working on, but we need to continue working on improving these fiduciary infrastructures in Oregon, in particular for this growing population that's engaging in our long-term service and support systems. So thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Kenny Geyer and the committee members. My name is Allison Lindauer. I'm a nurse practitioner and a researcher at the Latent Aging and Alzheimer's Center at OHSU. And I'm here to talk to you about some of the research that's coming up. But first, I'd like to thank you, Chair Kenny Geyer and the committee members for the work that you've done to advocate for telemedicine care in Oregon. Dr. Erton Lyons and I are lead researchers on a project called Alzheimer's Care via Telemedicine in Oregon, also known as ACT-ON. The aim of this project is to care for Oregonians living with Alzheimer's and their family caregivers using direct-to-home telemedicine remote technology. ACT-ON is funded through the Oregon Health Authority's Federal State Innovation Grant. As you well know, Oregon is facing a daunting challenge in addressing the needs of citizens with Alzheimer's disease. One concerning challenge is that access to expert care is limited to urban citizens because specialists such as myself and Dr. Erton Lyons tend to be located in metropolitan areas. Furthermore, cognitive and physical impairments related to Alzheimer's can make travel to clinic sites difficult regardless of the distance. And there's a caregiver testimony in your packet. These issues converge into restricted access to specialty care for the substantial proportion of the 60,000 Oregonians with Alzheimer's disease and related dementias. Through our research at OHSU, we aim to help families with Alzheimer's by providing high-quality telemedicine care directly to the home. Currently, in order to receive telemedicine care, Medicare beneficiaries must live in a rural county and must drive to a Medicare-covered originating site, such as a hospital or clinic. Citizens who are covered by Medicare cannot receive direct-to-home telemedicine care. Our study, the first of its kind in Oregon, will test the feasibility of direct-to-home care in Oregon for patients with Alzheimer's. Telemedicine care is cost-effective, saving both patients and providers time and money. In addition, telemedicine Alzheimer's care has the potential to delay skilled nursing home placement. By age 76, almost 50% of persons with Alzheimer's live in skilled care, pushing the annual national cost of dementia care to $150 billion. Research has shown that ongoing telephone support can reduce the rate of skilled care placement by 28%. So for Oregon, this could translate into millions of dollars of savings. Our ACT-ON project advances the state plan's goals by increasing access to specialty care, but it will only serve 80 families. We are currently seeking extra funding through other resources to sustain this program once our study is completed. We appreciate the work that you've done to increase access to telemedicine care in Oregon, and I want to thank you for this opportunity to discuss our research.
Thank you. Any questions?
Thank you. On the telemedicine side, because I have been very interested in that since I've been here, are you reimbursed at the same rate as an in-site visit, or what does that look like for you?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. No. Because our plan to provide direct-to-home telemedicine care, Medicare does not reimburse that. Now, Senate Bill 144 does allow for private insurers to reimburse for direct-to-home care. But many of our patients are over 65 and do have Medicare. If they do want those services paid for, they need to actually drive somewhere to connect with us remotely, and they need to live in a designated rural area. So as it stands now, if we were to use Medicare to be reimbursed for direct-to-home telemedicine care, that wouldn't happen.
Can I follow up?
Yes.
So you've got a patient who, I mean, this is not a, got a patient who has Alzheimer's, uh-huh. And if they'd like telemedicine and they have Medicare, or Medicaid or whatever, mm-hmm. You can't service them, but for this maybe small population, but we're asking an Alzheimer's patient to get in a car and go somewhere to, or have their family member drag them, like, that doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me, you know? I mean, that's probably not the smartest thing.
Yeah.
So I mean, as we looked at, you know, have this conversation around like CCOs, mm-hmm. certainly, and I mean, how can we better fit that into that type of service for those patients? Because really, again, that just makes no darn sense. Mm-hmm. We're going to ask an Alzheimer's patient to get in a car and go somewhere remotely where you can have a telemedicine visit.
Yeah. Yeah, you're singing my song. That's why we're doing the study. What we hope to do, we're going to do this study with just 80 families, and then what we hope to do is take this data and go to Medicare and say, step forward. There's currently some revisions swirling around about allowing for ACOs to reimburse for direct to home telemedicine care, but it's still in the works. And as it stands now, if a person wants telemedicine care from us or any other specialist, if it's direct to home, they would just have to pay the $324 out of pocket to get that care.
$324 for one visit?
Mm-hmm.
Wow. And what is driving that cost? And I ask that because I've got a company in my district that provides and works with self-insureds as a general rule, because he's not in the insurance plans or the exchange or anything, but can deliver a primary care visit for $39.
Mm-hmm.
So what are you doing differently in an Alzheimer telemedicine visit that is not the same as a primary care type visit, you know, for somebody who doesn't have Alzheimer's? Because that's a pretty big gap.
It is. It's a huge gap. And the reason I know that figure is because one of the things we wanted to try to do is say, well, if we develop this program, let's just offer it to people free of charge. Well, apparently there are constraints about what we can do as Medicare providers to do that. We are not allowed to just give a reduced rate or a free rate. It's constrained by what I'm told by Medicare and by OHSU billing. Mm-hmm. Because we're a specialties practice, what we do differently, if you will, is we're able to do more intensive cognitive testing to get a better sense of how a person is doing. And we also can help manage the variety of medications that many primary care providers are very comfortable with and some just aren't. So it's a fair question. It's in our own clinic practice right now, we spend a lot of time providing the cognitive and the medical expertise. We also spend just a lot of time with families.
Can I follow up?
Sure.
Follow. So in another universe, one of my children needed some cognitive therapy. We sent him to a and if you wanted to, and our insurance covered it, fortunately, if you wanted to pay cash, though, if you're a cash patient, that visit was still $160. So I'm sort of, help me understand $324 for a visit, because I'm just still trying to wrap my head
around
that.
I'd like to be able to help you understand that more clearly. And today, I probably don't have the data to really to give you the details of that. I have asked this question of our billing office, and the answer that keeps coming back to me is because of Medicare and Medicaid restrictions and because of the OHSU restrictions, we cannot bill less than that. But I'm happy to connect with you about that and give you more details about it.
Is that what you bill private insurance, though, the same?
Unfortunately, I don't know.
Okay.
Yeah. But you're right. I mean, with the private insurance, because of the work you've done, we can bill for direct-to-home telemedicine care. But it's the Medicare, Medicaid issue that we can't. But I'm happy to get back to you about the details of that, because I think it's an important point, and it's why we're doing this, is to give data to the federal government to say this is meaningful and important.
Good question. I'm sure you're going to be on it.
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, when you look at the different types of care that's being delivered, and I guess I don't understand what is being delivered in that time, or how much time you're actually spending with the patient. Are we talking a 15-minute visit or an hour-long visit? Or, you know, but again, an hour of cognitive therapy for a child was $160. Mm-hmm. So what's $324? Right. Why, you know, what's the different
kind
of...
You can help them get that cost down.
Yeah,
right.
What's the different kind of, you know...
Right.
And you help them get that cost down. That's right.
Anyway, so that's what I was trying to wrap my head around. So.
Yeah, good.
And I'll get back to you on that.
Thanks. But Peyton, did you have a question?
Yeah, the question was through a waiver process, even though it takes a while, that could be corrected,
yes.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We'd have to go ask for one.
Mm-hmm. You'd have to apply for that. Mm-hmm.
Well, I know you have to get to the Senate, too. You probably want a few minutes break. But thank you so much.
Thank you.
For
thank you.
Illuminating us. We'll be eager to follow up on the SPADA report.
I will. Thanks.
Thank you. Okay, so I'm going to close the informational hearing. And our next meeting, colleagues, is next Monday, June 1st. We're going to have an informational hearing on Section 8 housing. And we'll be here having a public hearing on Senate Bills 244 and 444. And with that, I adjourn.